Accession number 10180, Rule 9.
Mr. John Hatfield, Reel 9. I wonder if you could tell me now a little about the social life that you and your comrades had on the Rock of Gibraltar during this period.
Right. Well, obviously it was very, it was a very crowded place. There were supposed to be about 5,000 men and 300 women, mostly wrens. So it was an ideal situation in some ways for young women because each one had an enormous social value. But in another sense, it was a very artificial situation. The authorities tried to run various activities to keep the men happy. For example, they had things like literary competitions and a newspaper published for the troops and things of that sort, concerts, amateur theatricals and so on. I actually won two prizes in the literary literary competition, one for a poem and one for an essay. I was never quite sure whether I was pleased or not because I'm not sure how good the standard was. I was lucky because, as I said, I knew quite a few of the wrens. A lot of them were working in my own unit. And so I and my friends who shared a flat with me had a lot of relatively big amount of lady friends. But, of course, as I think I've said before, in those days we were all unbelievably moral by modern standards, and they literally were just friends, which was quite civilizing in a way. Apart from that, there was a place called the Officers' Library, which had existed in Nelson's time and was very proud to keep newspapers with accounts of the Battle of Trafalgar. There was also a little cemetery which had people buried from the who were died in the Battle of Trafalgar. Quite a few things of that sort linked the Rock with past history and made it quite an interesting place to be in.
Did you have any responsibility to keep the people under your command amused, or of your unit?
Yes, more directly for the men, because the women were supposed to be looked after by the rather shadowy an important figure called the Chief Wren, who ran the wrenery where they lived. So I didn't have responsibility for keeping them healthy, as it were. One had to not intrude too much on their privacy. But with the men, I used to I'd take them for PE myself about twice a week, and we used to do exercises and go running round the Rock much faster than what's called jogging nowadays. And I think everybody enjoyed it because the climate was very good. We also had parties occasionally, which I think were unusual. A party organized jointly by the men and the officers in the huts among the trees on the top of the Rock, where the actual food was organized by one of the leading telegraphists, who in private life owned a fairly famous hotel in Stratford-on-Avon, I believe. I've often thought I'd like to call on him, but never have done. So they were very successful, and there was a nice atmosphere of comradeship on the whole among the whole group of us.
Would you rather have had a more active service post, or?
Oh yes, I mean, I always thought when I was in Gibraltar that was just a temporary thing, and I wanted to go back to service at sea because it seemed that was the only thing that was really worth doing, if you see what I mean. If you were fit enough to be at sea, you felt you had to be at sea. And this brings up a little thing I've sometimes thought of since, and I've mentioned to women friends who never reacted very well. In those days, anything that a woman can do, or a wren could do in the Navy, she did, on the whole, and the men felt that if a girl could do it, then the man ought to be doing something different. In other words, women couldn't go to sea. So if you were fit, a man had to go to sea. If both men and women could do the same job, some of us felt that the man ought to try and find something a bit more difficult, which a woman couldn't do. Now, modern women think this is terribly sexist, and so on. But I don't think so. I think it was a feeling that you had to do your best, and you had to aim at the highest you could achieve. And naturally, you couldn't have women at sea, really, for a number of reasons. But quite a few of the wrens did quite difficult and dangerous jobs, like running little boats up and collecting people from ships, or signalling and going out at sea, in fact, in a small boat, to collect messages from convoys, things of that type. So they did the most they could, and we did the best we could, at least we tried to. So I always thought I'd go back to sea, and if I hadn't been posted back, I think I'd have agitated for it. So eventually I did.
Did you enjoy your time at Gibraltar overall?
Oh, I enjoyed it, because we were living a much less rigid life, and it was interesting. And of course I liked the contact with a sort of Spanish atmosphere. And later on in the time I was there, we were actually allowed to go to Spain for the day, on weekend, on day passes. So I went to a bullfight, where one of the bullfighters was the waiter in the hotel where we were living at the time. And that was marvellous for me, this contact with Spain.
Now, you were now back in Spain briefly. What did you think now about Franco, and did you have any retrospective views of the Spanish Civil War?
That was interesting too, because by that time I was very against Franco and hated the whole system. And of course the Spanish were to some extent helping the Germans, and we used to see lights flashing all around the Spanish hills across the bay from Gibraltar, which were always supposed to be spies reporting on the ships in the harbour. And when you went to Algeciras, which is the little town opposite Gibraltar, you mixed with Germans. I mean, I remember going into the famous hotel, the Hotel Cristina, which still exists, which actually was owned by an English titled person. And in the bar, there was a kind of caricature of a Nazi in civilian clothes sitting almost opposite me, and we just ignored each other while we had drinks. It was like something out of a film. And generally, the Spanish didn't show any particular feelings either way. They weren't very interested. They just wanted to smuggle food and tobacco and things like that and get jobs in Gibraltar. There was an Italian unit or units which used to operate with one-man submarines and mines, and occasionally would sink ships in the harbour. And we captured once, at least one was captured, a young chap. And a message came round: does any officer speak Italian? Because he needs to. This man needs to be interrogated. This just shows how efficient the Navy was in those days. So I thought, well, I don't really speak Italian, but I can understand it a bit. So I put my name forward. And in due course, I was summoned to the army jail. And this young, very young Italian, about 18, was produced, who looked a mixture of terrified and defiant. And an officer and a sergeant and I interrogated him. The sergeant had the brilliant idea of trying to frighten him by bullying him, and apparently had actually measured his neck with a tape measure, pretending he was going to be hanged, which I thought was disgusting. And so I was asked to say, where do you come from? And he said, I can't say, non posso dire. That's all he said, I can't say. Oh, we know you come from a submarine outside. We know this. No, I can't say, etc. The theory was that they were landed from submarines and then dropped from submarines and then attacked ships. In fact, it was found later, they all came from a sunken ship which was beached on the Spanish side of the Bay of Gibraltar, which had a sort of underground, underwater workshop and a trap door. They just sailed out of there, and apparently we never discovered this. But it was interesting going to Spain, and we generally felt, and I shared this, that the Spanish were being too helpful to the Germans.
You didn't get any chance to meet anybody you'd known in Spain?
No. Oh, well, only by a fluke, because two English people came to Gibraltar from the British Embassy in Madrid and gave us a talk about the network that had been built up to help British pilots who'd been British airmen who'd escaped from France right through Spain, and then from there sometimes they found their way to Gibraltar and sometimes elsewhere. And one of these two English chaps had been at school with me in Madrid. He later became an ambassador.
Did you talk to him?
Yes, oh yes, I talked to him. It was very strange meeting him in those in that situation.
Did he share your views of what was happening?
Oh, I think so, yes. I mean, by that time all the British were against Franco. The only thing you could... And there was a fear, actually, at that time, that Franco might let the Germans through Spain in order to capture Gibraltar. And when he didn't, it was felt rightly, I think, that he'd actually done something sensible for once, that he'd protected Spain from another war. And he seems to have been the only person who managed to outwit Hitler or to outface him in a face-to-face argument. So in that sense, there was a feeling of relief, but it had been quite tricky at one time.
Now, at the next stage, you're about to not leave the British Navy, but you went to serve with the Free French. We'll come to that. But before you leave, was there anything about your period of serving with the British Navy that you'd like to comment on?
Well, yes. I really did enjoy being in the Navy, and I liked a lot of the things that I found in it, which seemed to me to be historic survivals. A lot of the petty officers used to say as a joke that things weren't like this in Nelson's time, or Nelson wouldn't have approved of this kind of thing, meaning if you didn't behave properly. But in fact, I think the Navy in those days still had a very great amount of style and atmosphere from the old days of sail. And even the language was like that. For instance, it used to amaze me to find that people actually said, belay that, meaning ignore that or stop that, because to belay is to fix a rope temporarily around something. And I always thought that was just something you read in Peter Pan, like, avast belay, yo-ho, heave to. People actually did say, oh-ho, not quite yo-ho, but oh-ho, when pulling a rope. And an expression, the normal expression for fed up was chocker. I'm chocker, mate. And that's from chock a block. See, chock a block really means a chock on a block. The chock is the bottom part of a wooden pulley or block, and the block is the top part. So chock on block is something that can't go any further. Chock a block. And the proper word for a rope and pulley is a block and tackle. I could never make up why it's tackle and not tackle, but you had to say tackle. Vast heaving for stop pulling, and so on. A lot of these old expressions, which I loved because I was always interested in language. And then, of course, the slang was quite good, like tiddly meant smart. A tiddly suit was a special suit you had made to be smart. Stroppy meant bad-mannered, badly behaved. You were getting stroppy, mate, you know, if you thought somebody was doing something unpleasant.
What was that from? Do you know the
derivation? No, where that comes from. No, a strop, the proper meaning of strop is a kind of piece of rope used to tie one thing with another. It's like a kind of rope that hangs down from a boat or a ship. But why stroppy? I don't know. Of course, everybody called everybody as mate. And if you had a special friend, you called him your oppo, opposite number, you see. Because in watches, you very often had an opposite number who did the same as you did in the other watch. So an oppo is a friend. And quite a few like that, which I thought were quite good. Then other expressions like names for ranks. A bosun in a small ship was always a buffer. The tanky was the man who looked after the stores. The first lieutenant was Jimmy the One, or Jimmy. The ratings called him Jimmy. The officers called him Number One, and so on. I think there's other expressions, like cigarettes made from naval tobacco were called ticklers. Puddings were called oggies. Oggie, that's a West Country word, I think. And people from Devonport were called tiddly oggies. In other words, oggies because they were from the West Country and ate puddings, and tiddly because they thought they were smart. And so on. The other thing I thought was interesting was that the way the drill is done in the Navy is different from the Army. As much as jumping around and stamping, when you're called to attention, You don't have to jump in the air and stamp your feet down. You just put your 2 feet together smartly. And we used to try and do the rifle drill elegantly and sharply, but without exaggerating. In Whale Island, where I was for 2 periods, once as a rating and once as an officer, that's the Naval Gunnery School, HMS Excellent. All the ratings, and the officers too, as far as I remember, used to have to go at the double everywhere. It was sort of much more difficult than anywhere else. You had to double around everywhere. And all the petty officers carried a cutlass, which they carried in the normal regulation way at right angles to their body, sort of sticking up, as if you were carrying a candlestick. And the march pasts were really very dramatic. The style and the standard was extremely high. And when the captain or the chief petty officer, I suppose, would shout, "Excellent! Run!" You know, the whole place sounded as if it really was excellent. Anyway, things like that meant that I felt the Navy had more style than the other services, and it was more humane, too, in many ways. The whole system of discipline was much more understanding than one expected. On the whole, although there were some tough petty officers particularly, on the whole, a lot of the toughness was on the surface, and they were really quite wise people.
Right, now coming to when you moved, did you notice that the Battle of the Atlantic was winding down? could you tell that the British were getting on top? Or?
Well, yes, because I knew I had the information, and it wasn't finished by any means. And what had happened was that it had gone to a new phase. The Germans had invented the Schnorkel, which was a kind of tube that you could have extended from the submarine when it was underwater, so that it could get air, and that extended its range. The Germans had also invented new types of torpedoes, electric torpedoes and homing torpedoes. So in a sense, it was getting worse in that sense. They were using wolf packs more, but the Navy was increasing its use of hunter killers, in other words, groups of escort and the ships and destroyers. And one felt that probably the corner had been turned, and also there were fewer German submarines around. It was a bit like the question of the V1s and the V2s a bit later. New inventions were coming in on the German side, but somehow one felt that they'd lost their impetus. So it wasn't 100% clear that we'd won the battle, but it was a new phase.
How did you come to leave Gibraltar?
Well, I think the winding down of our own Y activities, which certainly happened, which meant that I was the last officer left in charge, and that we knew that the one day soon the unit would be closed down, that gave me the feeling that I wasn't going to be there much longer.
Why wasn't the Y? Why weren't they needed anymore?
I think because of the change in the nature of the Battle of the Atlantic, but I'm not 100% clear. One thing I remember clearly from the war is that you never really knew what was going on.
Did the Germans stop their signals?
No, I don't think so. I think it just wasn't... Either was no longer necessary to have a station in Gibraltar itself, or maybe the whole system of control over the Battle of the Atlantic had changed. I'm not sure. Anyway, one day I got a letter from my Lord's Commissioners, sending me home on long leave, and then soon after that I got another letter appointing me as British Naval Liaison Officer to the Free French Motor Torpedo Boat Flotilla.
When did you leave Gibraltar then? Do you know the month?
Soon after the invasion of France. I remember I was very annoyed that I'd missed all this invasion and that I had to sit there while it was happening. So it must have been late May, I think. There was the invasion May or June? I can't remember. June. It must have been June. June 1944.
Now, you went on leave.
I went on leave.
How long was this long leave?
Well, usually a few weeks. I can't remember.
And then you were posted as British Liaison Officer to the Free French Motor Torpedo Boat Flotilla.
That's right.
What number was that known as?
23rd MTB Flotilla.
And where was it based?
Dartmouth, in Devonshire.
Now, You were going to be British liaison officer.
Yes.
What were you told that would involve before you got there? Were you given any instructions?
I don't think I was told anything, as far as I remember. You were just told to go and be it. And I guessed the sort of thing it would be. Well, I wasn't told until I got there. When I got there, I reported, I suppose, to the RN commander of the small base, which was actually at Kingswear on the opposite side of the river from Dartmouth, in what was the railway station. It is a sort of railway station, again, for a small branch line, private line. And I was then introduced to my predecessor, who was an officer like myself, an RNVR officer, who spoke fluent Norwegian. And he'd been with the Free French for approximately 3 weeks, I think, and the Navy had had the sense to replace him. Although the other ones they'd had before didn't speak much French either. So then I was left on my own that evening and made my way to one of the French boats. They were all at that time anchored in the river. Went on board. The officer on duty received me. He was a great big fat French chap. Plied me with gin, which was something I didn't like very much. And I was so enthusiastic about joining that I drank a lot of it and went to my quarters completely drunk and as sick as anything. It was my first glorious evening in that apartment.
Where were these quarters?
In a boarding house. I shared a room in a boarding house.
That had been fixed up for
you? Yes, it had been fixed up. And it had been requisitioned by the Navy and taken over as quarters for the officers.
From the sound of it, this was a reasonably friendly reception then from your
first
contact.
Oh, yes. I enjoyed it. And then I met the rest of the flotilla, including the senior officer, the next morning. And I think my duties were partly explained to me, presumably, although I don't remember, by the RN base commander and partly by the French.
What were these duties to be then?
Well, what they were was, first of all, to act as a link with the British Navy, as the name implies, to make sure that the Free French unit I was attached to had everything they needed to be operationally efficient, and also for morale and general welfare. And the other way around, I had the duty of making sure that they fitted in with British naval requirements, that they knew what was happening, that they were properly informed, and but they didn't go and do something quite separate of their own, which they were always in danger of doing. And thirdly, I also had the duty, which was explained to me later, of making a report. I think once a month or once every 2 months or once every 3 months on the morale and the attitude of the flotilla as a whole. Now, this was when it was discovered by the French, they were furious because they thought this was spying on them. And I remember I was accused by the senior officer of being a member of the intelligence service. But in fact, it was meant quite genuinely as a way of knowing what they felt, what they needed and what was happening.
I believe you had some British telegraphists.
Yes,
as well.
We had 17 British telegraphists, two in each boat. There were 8 boats in the flotilla and 1 spare. And they came under my command, so that was my other duty, to look after them for welfare, for discipline, for all purposes. Everybody has to report to somebody in the Navy, so they reported to me. And I reported in a very vague and nebulous way to the Admiralty. It was left beautifully, gloriously unclear as to who I reported to. This is one reason I liked the job, because I really could do exactly what I wanted as long as I did the right thing. And that was very good.
Now, there were 8 boats.
Yes.
Which type were they?
They were the small MTBs, not the D class. They were Vospers, 60 tons when fully loaded, 3 Packard engines and 2 Ford auxiliaries just for moving around in harbour and for lighting and so on. Top speed 42 knots and so on. They were standard 90 foot MTBs, which were the basic MTBs. And they had been given to this Free French flotilla about a couple of years before, I think, In fact, I had met them, as I mentioned earlier, in Dartmouth once. Yes, the actual flotilla was constituted between November 42 and January 43.
What crew were on each boat?
Each boat had a crew of about 12 to 14 men and two officers.
Is that including or excluding the two telegraphists?
Including the two telegraphists. Yes.
Right, how did you set about your duties then? You had this lodging,
yes.
You'd met this French, the first one.
Yeah, then I met the senior officer and most of the other officers.
How did you set about doing your job?
Well, I attended a conference in which the basic objectives were discussed. I think they would have been anyway, but they may have done it in more detail because I was there. In a base sort of headquarters ship we had, which was an old hulk moored in the river, I realised the kind of thing I had to do, and I decided that one of the most important things was obviously to gain their confidence. I decided that I would be on their side, if you like. I wouldn't be an external person representing the British Navy, foreign to them. I would be part of them, if I could, because I would enjoy that more, and I thought it would work better, while obviously remaining chiefly loyal to the British Navy. And I also decided that although I wasn't attached to any of the boats, I was attached to the flotilla, and I needn't have gone out on patrol with them if I didn't want to. I could have just stayed ashore, and some of the previous officers did that. I decided that I wouldn't, that I would go out with them every time they went on duty, on patrol, which meant, in fact, that I went out on patrol more than anybody else did, because the flotilla never went out as a whole. Usually only half went out at a time. So I used to just go on one of the boats and stay on the bridge. I didn't have any specific duties.
Before we come to that, what were these objectives that they discussed?
The objectives were to be very aggressively on the attack within the particular sector of the channel that they'd been allotted, which was mainly around the Channel Islands and off the coast of Brittany. I should explain, the senior officer had only been appointed just before I got there. He, in fact, was a marine officer. And in the French Navy, the Marines are more part of the Navy than they are in Britain. He had actually served in North Africa at the Battle of Bir Hakeim, where the Free French played a very gallant role when they were besieged by Rommel. He had then been flown to Dartmouth and appointed, just like that, the day he arrived, to this flotilla. He'd never actually commanded boats before, as far as I know. He was an extremely tense and almost fanatically dedicated man who didn't look like a hero, as so often happens. He was very nervous. He always had a drip on the end of his nose and always very pale and demanding in a kind of unbrutal way, if you can see what I mean.
What was his name?
Yehle, I-E-H-L-E. He was an Alsatian, a Protestant, which is unusual in France. And from the beginning, the men and the officers respected him tremendously. Somehow he managed to give this feeling of urgency to them. And so his objective was to be always better than anybody else. His flotilla was going to be better than any of the British flotillas, which was difficult because they respected the British MTB officers that they'd worked with very much. And they were, on the whole, very good.